that in relationships, you know. What they do is maintain fragile peace. And I actually think that probably works if you're bounded by rules. And this was a Jungian observation. So Jung believed that you didn't have to have an individual relationship if you were in a traditional culture, because women did women things and men did men things, and they walked along the path in parallel, and there were no conflicts, because most of what you were supposed to do was laid out for you. And, you know, modern people don't like that idea, but just try negotiating over who should cook dinner. See if you can settle that before you make a decision about whether roles are useful or not. Because, you know, I've been in lots of houses where that fight had been going on for 35 years. Never solved. So kids couldn't eat. The food was terrible. The husband and the wife were at each other's throats. You know, fun. So it's really hard once you're out of the roles. Once you're out of the roles, you have to do it as an individual. But that's a tremendous demand. It's an unbelievable demand. It's the same demand that Dostoevsky put on himself. It's like, we're partners. We'll say, you are one weird and unwieldy and malevolent and peculiar creature. And so am I. So, like, how the hell are we going to sort that out? Well, you better be awake if you're going to sort that out. But the alternative is the Gottman situation, right? Everything's fine. And your heart's racing and your cortisol is generating and, you know, you're having murderous dreams. I've had clients who were very motivated to commit homicide. And they had their reasons. And one client I'm thinking about, she thought it was her moral duty to do this because the person that she hated had really hurt their family. Like, not in some trivial way, but, like, hurt them as badly as she possibly could. But there was nothing she could do about it. There was no legal recourse. And so she was a very moral person. In fact, somewhat, I would say, doesn't matter. She's a very moral person. And this was just driving her crazy. It's like, I have to act. I can't just let this person get away with it. Because it was also ongoing. Well, what are you going to say? Well, stop thinking about that. You know, you could put your thoughts to a more productive use. It's like, it's not helpful. You can't help a person like that at all until you put yourself in their situation. You think, okay, if I was in that situation and that had happened, what would I do? And then the first thing I thought was, oh, I'd be having the same kind of murderous fantasies. So that doesn't seem like, it's possible that that's not a great solution. So let's see if we can come up with something else. But the danger there is that you have to put yourself in that situation. And people don't like to do that because they think, oh, well, I'd never have murderous fantasies. It's like, if you would never have murderous fantasies, I would actually say there's something wrong with you. If you're not capable of that, then there's a half of you missing. It's in there, man. And when someone's pushing on you at some point in your life, and they will, you better have that reserve capacity or they're just going to mow you right over. So you could see what this would mean. It would simply mean that before presenting your own point of view, it would be necessary for you to really achieve the other speaker's frame of reference, to understand his thoughts and feelings so well that you could summarize them for him. Sounds simple, doesn't it? But if you try it, you will discover it is one of the most difficult things you have ever tried to do. However, once you have been able to see the other's point of view, your own comments will have to be drastically revised. You will also find the emotion going out of the discussion, the differences being reduced, and those differences which remain being of a rational and understandable sort. So Rogers thought that courage was a prerequisite for empathic understanding. It's interesting, too, because, you know, here's a question for you. It's like, should you trust people? Or more specifically, you know, should I trust you? Well, you might think, if you've heard me talk, you'd think, well, there's no way you should trust a person because they're just so full of snakes and malevolence that it's just absolutely mind-boggling. So why in the world would you ever trust something like that? Well, then you can think about it this way. There's two kinds of trust. There's the kind of trust you have when you're too stupid to know better, and that's not trust, that's naivete, and that is not a moral virtue. And there's the kind of trust you have when you know that the person you're talking to and you are completely full of snakes, and you decide as an act of courage that you're going to trust the person anyways because that of all the things you could do to help lead them and the discussion towards the light, that's the most important. It's like, I'm going to assume that in our interactions, your impulse towards the good is going to be victorious. Now, is it? If you're interested in this, you could go online. You could watch Paul Bernardo. You remember old Paul Bernardo? Okay, there's videos of Paul Bernardo online when he's talking to a bunch of RCMP officers and judges. They're trying to extract some more information from him about some murders that remained unsolved. You want to see a psychopath in operation, you can just watch those videos. It's amazing. He runs the meeting like he's the CEO of Apple. It's amazing. So, and that's a problem, I would say, to some degree for the Rogerian approach, right? Because, well, what about Paul Bernardo? You know, is everyone fundamentally oriented towards the good? Well, it's a reasonable presupposition most of the time, I think. It works better if societies organize themselves according to that principle, because otherwise we know, for example, that one of the, you might think, what's a natural resource? Oil, right? Or bauxite or iron ore, or forget about all that. The fundamental natural resource is trust. So if you look around the world and you look at economies like Japan, for example, Japan has no natural resources, right? Well, they're filthy rich. Why? Because the economy is basically predicated on interpersonal trust. So, and there's been some lovely work done in economics regarding precisely that. Without trust, your oil just sits in the ground or leaks out of the pipelines because nobody welded them properly. You know, there's no reason to assume that you're going to be able to do anything cooperative or collaborative. So trust is a necessity. If you're really willing to understand a person in this way, if you're willing to enter his private world and see the way life appears to him, you run the risk of being changed yourself. You might see it his way. You might find yourself influenced in your attitudes or personality. The risk of being changed is one of the most frightening prospects most of us can face. If I enter as fully as I am able into the private world of the neurotic or psychotic individual, isn't there a risk that I might become lost in that world? Most of us are afraid to take that risk. The great majority of us cannot listen. We find ourselves compelled to evaluate because listening is too dangerous. The first requirement is courage, and we do not always have it. So it says 3 o'clock on this. Is that right? Well, that's a good place to stop then. Yeah.